Oliver Callan on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by It's For Women. You are not 9 to 5 and neither are we. Conveniently open online 365 days per year, 24 hours per day. Oliver Callan on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by It's For Women. You are not 9 to 5 and neither are we. Conveniently open online 365 days per year, 24 hours per day.
Oliver Callan on RTE Radio 1.
Welcome back. 51551 is our text now. Maura Trasany Callig has had a couple of different careers, all of them very interesting, but she had a dream of becoming a doctor, a GP, but it didn't quite go according to plan. She's in studio with us. Good morning to you, Maura Trasa.
Good morning.
The number of careers you had, you've had a few of them. Let's get those out of the way first of all to discover how you ended up on this path.
Jack of all trades, master of none, I think. I grew up in Connemara in County Galway, just over the road from TG Cahir. So back in the day, kind of when I wasn't going to college for the first time, TG Cahir was still very brand new and glamorous, and a lot of us kind of looked at that and said, oh geez, that's kind of cool.
Makes sense, that's a place to go. Yeah,
and there's jobs, which, you know, weren't particularly fulsome in Connemara. I did a degree in Galway, I did a degree in Irish and psychology, and then I did a HDIP in applied communications, because again, TV, radio was all there on your doorstep, and at that time they really were actively hiring, and kind of fell into media. I mean, I wouldn't say I was particularly good at it, but I'm not bad at talking, so that helps. And worked in radio in the Gaeltachta first off, doing local news and then national news and that kind of thing, and then got a job in TG Cahir and worked there for a few years. And then I ended up moving up here to Dublin. Actually, I worked here in RTE for a few years as well in the newsroom. I was working for Nuachta News, and I did one stint as well as a summer of GAA reporter under Marty Morrissey.
Really?
That was a bit of crack,
And, did you love working in the media?
I loved facets of it. I realised very quickly that hard news wasn't for me. I used to find it very stressful. So then I managed to manoeuvre my way into sport. And that was really where I found the draw, because that was live broadcasting, which is great fun. As I mentioned there, my original degree was psychology, and I had a draw for that, but I never really knew what I wanted to do with it. And also, the options weren't as varied then. And then I kind of realised, I love sport. I love psychology. So why not try and marry them and do sports psychology? So
you did?
Yeah, I did a master's degree while working here, actually, in sports psychology down in UL. And that's kind of what led me onto the path to medicine, because I kind of learned that there was so much I didn't know. And I began to realise I didn't know what I knew what I didn't know. And I said to myself, right, the whole mind-body axis, physical health, mental health, it all ties into one and well-being. And well, sports psychology is really interesting. We think it only affects like the top 0.5% of the population. But then I suddenly realised there's a lot of sports psychology that if the likes of me and you applied to our daily lives, makes life easier, better, more effective. Okay. And this is why you actually see a lot of corporate people now bringing in people who've worked in sports and sports psychology.
Because of the goals and driving
yourself
towards
exactly.
them.
And a bit of positive psychology as well. I used to be very cynical, believe it or not. Maybe it's working in news.
Perfect for news.
But I kind of learned like that's not good for your well-being. So I kind of proactively learned ways to make myself that little bit more optimistic. And then that kind of opens up the little door of self-belief. And all of a sudden it was like, oh, I might do a PhD in this. This is fascinating. I love the mind. And then, like, because the confidence built up, it was like, well, you know, you did think, you know, back in the day when you were in school, you were very good at school. I was very lucky. I was book smart, no street smarts, but very good at reading books and doing exams.
Yeah.
So I said, why not try the whole medicine thing? Because that's where you get the whole mind and body thing. So that's kind of what
I like
led
how
me.
At a young age, you sort of knew what you wanted to do, and you took on each stage, didn't you? So you went from news to sport to sports psychology. You identified medicine.
Or did I fall into them? I think possibly by the time I got to sports psychology stage, I kind of knew what I was at. But it took all my 20s to do the long meandering roads.
None of it wasted, though, to be fair.
No.
So you wanted to be the GP. How do you start this process? I mean, when you've got a psychology degree, we know the normal route, maybe leaving search and into medicine. Where did you start from?
It's a different route for sure. So a few years ago, I say it's about 10, 12 years ago now, Ireland started off graduate entry medicine, which is a way for people who already have a degree who potentially might have wanted medicine, their leaving cert didn't get the points, or potentially may have come back to medicine later in life like me.
You
can apply for that. You sit a god-awful exam called the GAMSAT exam. And I sat that GAMSAT exam in UCD. You start at 9 a.m. and you're not out till 6 that night. And if you get a specific mark, you get yourself into your choice of medical school. Plus, you have to have had a 2-1 previous degree. Now, the 2-1 previous degree could have been in painting. It doesn't matter so long as it's a 2-1.
It has to be 2-1 at least.
And you get your specific mark in GAMSAT. And that gets you into
the entry exam.
Yeah, to the accelerated 4-year medical degree. So normally some people might do medicine over 5, 6, 7 years. I went into the Royal College of Surgeons and did it in 4.
That must be an intense 4 years.
You know that feeling when you're overwhelmed all the time and your heart's going 90 and you can't breathe for 4 years?
Yeah. You're not really ready. But
oh,
you
no,
loved
it. Was great. I did love it. I really did love it. The whole idea of the GAMSAT exam is that's meant to show them that you've picked up a baseline of science so that you can go in at the accelerated level. So the first year was very tough. It was very, you know, chemistry, physics, biology, that kind of stuff. So that was really hard.
Intense 4 years. What happens next?
Well, first of all, you have to pass your degree. If you pass your degree, then you apply for a job. You get an intern job. You do your internship in any of the interning hospitals in Ireland. And then technically you are fully fledged technically as a doctor, but you're obviously not trained as a specialist in any specialty. And that's when you start applying to the various specialties, i.e. GP training.
So this is where you go to GP. So is that a year of
intern? That's 4 years. Internship is for one full year. And then GP training is 4 years.
Right. So you've done, at this stage, you've done 5 years of it. And now you've another 4 years to go to become a GP.
Yes.
Okay, wow. What happens in those 4 years?
In those 4 years, you've 2 years in a hospital and 2 years in various GP surgeries. So you go around specialties that could be useful.
Are there entry level exams here for that part? Are they kind of...
Yes. Okay. You apply for it. Yeah. So there's a process. You have to do an exam. And then if you get a decent enough mark in that exam, if they deem you eligible, then you go and you do an interview. And then if you pass the interview stage, then you are offered a place in the GP training.
Okay. So I didn't realise there were interviews to just... trained to become a GP.
Yes. Right? Yeah.
And how many places are there then?
It's increasing every year. I'm not 100% sure this year. I think it might be like 120 spaces, and it's going up to 130, 140, 150 because, as we know, we don't have enough of them in this country.
Yeah.
So you do that. So for two years.
I'm amazed because I know there's a kind of a shortage of GPs and all of that crack. I thought just any number of GPs are available, we'll train them up. But it's not.
Because it's very restrictive. It is very restrictive because there are places and hospitals that you need to have these GP trainees in there. And then also you need to have GP trainers dotted around the country who will take responsibility for somebody like me while I'm learning.
Okay, so you got to do this interview?
I did.
Okay, the circumstances were interesting?
Yes, they were indeed. I had had a baby 6 days before said interview. I looked like a ghost.
You don't do things by halves.
No, but like you kind of get sucked into this, oh, I have to do it. And so we got notification, I think in November, that... I was successful on the first hurdle, which was the exam, and we're going to host interviews. And we're telling you now the interviews will be held on the 8th and 9th of the specific month.
Yes.
I remember thinking, my baby's due on the 5th. And I sent them an email and I said, look, guys, just in case I don't show up, it's not that I'm not interested, it's just I might be in Holles Street.
Yeah. You know? And incredibly, you do the interview.
It was online, thankfully.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But still in all, it's the interview for, you know, becoming a GP.
Oh, I look like a ghost. Yeah. Like, I was very, very pale and very tired.
You get through it, but I'm just thinking you've got a newborn baby and now you're starting this 4 year regime to become a GP.
Mm.
And where does that begin?
Well, the doctor year, which for people not in the know, tends to start in July. That's when all the July training.
Okay, I didn't know.
Yeah, most people don't know. Why would they? Because, you know, people aren't in that circle. So that's when doctors change over in hospitals. That's when people go up a level. That's when people become brand new consultants, all that kind of stuff. And the interns start as well in July. So that was due to start in July. I wasn't able to, obviously, because of maternity leave and I had a few postpartum complications. So I was pushed forward to this July. And I asked then if I could do it part time because baby, and I also knew the hours in hospitals and stuff. You know, they're not conducive to childcare or to seeing family relatives or having a bath. You know,
any part of the family experience, it sounds like.
Yeah.
So do you, what happens?
It's moved to July and then you start in a hospital job and they put you into specialties that would be useful as you're a GP. So paediatric appointments, for example, obstetrics, which are handy when you're dealing with pregnant women who are coming into your surgery, geriatric medicine, emergency, that kind of thing, just to expose you more to conditions that you might see as a GP.
And it includes weekends and nights, a whole lot. And you've 4 years of this stretching out ahead.
You've 2 years of that and then you've 2 years working in GP surgeries. And you're still on call in those GP surgery years, but it's certainly not as intense as hospital medicine.
Of course. Yeah. So do you start the process?
So I asked if I could start part time and through various jigs and reels and roundabouts, I discovered no, it's not going to be facilitated.
Can't be done.
Then I asked, would it be possible to be placed in a hospital that would facilitate the childcare that I had arranged?
Yes.
Because they did have placements in various hospitals.
Oh, you don't get
me.
To choose the hospital again?
No.
Oh, right. Yeah. So you could be living anywhere in the country.
You could. Now, to be fair to the GP scheme, they are much more regionalised than all the other specialties. Mm-hmm. So I knew technically wherever they could put me would be within an hour of my house, which is really a gift because there's many doctors who start off in Cork and then in July are moved to Letterkenny. So for me, it was definitely going to be easier for anyone doing the GP training for that reason because they have, to be fair to them, they have regionalised it in that way. So I asked to go to one hospital where I knew I had childcare organised en route to said hospital. And I got no reply. And then I got an email last November telling me they were going to send me in a hospital the opposite direction, which would have meant my daily commute 2 hours each way.
So 4 hours in the car.
Yeah. On top of the 10 hours at work.
And a small child at home.
Yeah. And overnights and overtime. And so like the hours, as they say, the maths didn't math.
No. It's extraordinary because there's a shortage of staff.
Everywhere.
Everywhere.
Yeah.
And when you're offering to, I would have thought someone offering to work part-time there, they'd take the hand off you.
I would have thought so too, but ni mar a hita a bita, as we say in Connemara.
Translate for us.
It's not what you think is what's going to happen.
Right.
Yeah, I suppose it's the way to put it, yeah.
It's a real counter to what's for you won't pass you by.
Yeah.
Because it seems that this is not, this
might not be for me at all.
It's not for a young woman who's just had a baby.
No. And they will counter, you know, various training schemes. You know, the thing is, medicine and medical training has not moved with the times. Like, for example, the whole GAMSAT experience, those of us graduate entry, we're all older because we've done a degree. Most of us have worked a few years. So back in the day, people came in fresh off the boat, off the leaving cert. They were 22, 23 years old. They're not thinking of marriage and babies. And if they were, it was usually men. And they had a wife at home who looked after the homestead. That's not the way it is anymore. But the training definitely hasn't evolved with that.
So you realised this was your dream. You actually would have been a great asset to the health service. So, but you can't do it.
Not for the moment. I mean, I may come back to it in a few years' time when the baby's a bit older. But right now, it's just I can't do those hours. I don't want to do those hours. And I don't want to have to choose between a career and actually seeing my family. And I suppose the really sad thing is when I actually put this up on Instagram for the first time and spoke about it, I had an avalanche of messages from other women in the same position who've made the same choice. They've either backed away from training, they've quit training schemes, or they've ploughed their way through it. They've somehow managed to make it work. They've probably gone grey in age prematurely and at the end have felt, was it really worth it? And nobody's been able to tell me it has been. And they carry the guilt with them. Now, maybe that's mom guilt. Maybe men don't carry this guilt. I don't know. Mm-hmm. But it just was very sad.
How much did you spend on all this training and education to get to this point?
Ooh, a lot of money. The degree was roughly, the fees were €17,000 a year.
Wow.
Yeah. You're
looking at the guts of 80 grand.
Yeah. In a pandemic when I used to work on evenings and weekends in sports broadcasting.
Yes.
So all of a sudden my revenue stream kind of dried up as well. So it was a lean time. But look, we got through it, thankfully.
So you have borrowings still?
I do have borrowings. Good old credit union. Can't beat them.
Fair play to them. At least some bit of the system in the country is working.
They did. And to be fair, RCSI supported me as well. They were very good.
Just to give the context of what you're facing into, what is the day in the life of a trainee GP in hospitals in Ireland?
Depending on where you're placed, your day usually starts, say, if you're not on call, your day will start either at 8 or 9 a.m. You tend to round to the consultant, you see the new patients, and then you look after them during the day. And then if you're lucky, you might clock off at 5 or 6. If you're on-call shifts tend to be 8 a.m. to 8 p.m. You're carrying the on-call bleep. Often you're carrying, so that's getting all the phone calls of all the other sick patients in the hospital, the arrest bleep, the stroke bleep. And if you're on-call at night, you might be doing it 8 p.m. to 8 a.m. And there are some jobs, based depending on which hospital you're in, some people might show up on Friday morning for work and they might leave again, if they're lucky, till Saturday afternoon. Some people might still be in the hospital Monday morning.
Extraordinary.
Yeah.
I didn't even know some of the system, because obviously we know the consultants, they wander around the hospital. They're the kind of misters or whatever you call them.
Yeah.
Then you have the junior doctors, your trainee consultants essentially.
Some of them, yes.
The reference to that.
Yeah.
And then you have the trainee GPs.
Yeah.
But we don't have full GPs. Do you work in hospitals?
No. They're safely ensconced in the community.
What can a trainee GP do, for instance?
A trainee GP, you wouldn't know if you're in a hospital. Like, for example, a lot of the doctors that you see you first, if you have the misfortune of ending up in ED, is often a trainee GP.
Is that right?
Yeah, yeah. And they'll be the ones to first look after you, and then they'll be the ones then to start your management plan. And then if they have to, they might have to elevate up the system depending on how sick you are. So like, we don't tend to open up the curtain and say, "Howie Oliver, I'm the trainee GP." You just say, "Look, I'm one of the doctors here," and we go through it.
So you do that
for 2 years, and then you go out into the community and you start working in surgeries. And then you're also getting teaching on the side. There's usually an afternoon or a half day put aside one day a week for your teaching. So you get to go there and you're learning more medicine and also more exams.
God, people are screaming now, fill the emergency departments with trainee GPs. You know, because we know how long you've been in education at that point.
Yeah. And there's also a lot of people as well who aren't on training schemes. They're just doctors like me who have their degree, who've done their internship. They're allowed, qualified, so to speak, to work in a hospital, but they're not on a training pathway. So you can work at that level as well, and you can do some more exams to build you up, but you're not going to become a consultant in a thing, if you know what I mean, or you're not going to become a specialist anything, you're not going to become a GP. And some people are very happy with that as well. They're happy, you know, for example, you could potentially work through a recruitment agency and you're able to say, look, I'll work 2 days a week, or it helps facilitate childcare for a lot of people that way. Or they might get in touch with various hospital HRs and say, I'm available if you're stuck. And that's a good way as well to keep your skills up and to work 1, 2, 5 days a week, whatever suits that person.
This is obviously a very serious problem that's happening in our midst. The nurses are really good at coming together as a union and fighting for what they can get. Sometimes win, sometimes they don't, but they certainly seem to mobilise. We don't hear of trainee GPs coming together. What's going on there? Do you ever talk to your colleagues and so on?
Or trainee doctors. And it's something I've noticed from day one. It's something I noticed even before I went into healthcare, because you know when the nurses are having a problem, and they're dead right. It's the exact right way to go about it. Doctors aren't as vocal. I think part of the reason is they're so exhausted, they haven't got the time.
Right.
You're changing jobs every 4 to 6 months. And like I just said, you could potentially go from Cork to Letterkenny.
Okay.
So your little support network that you've built up and you've complained with each other for 6 months, then you're sent somewhere new.
You're not hanging out together.
Yeah.
And you don't have time to have meetings about it.
Exactly. And you also have the issue, and be it true or not, there's definitely a perception there that if you do speak up, there could be potential repercussions and you could be known as that troublemaker, and then you wouldn't know.
What would happen to them?
Well, there just seems to be a fear that their progression could be stalled, or they could end up potentially not being supported to get to where they want to go. Be that real or not, or is it just a perception they have?
Okay, it's extraordinary.
Yeah.
So the GP system, you would have had to do those 2 years in the hospital, 2 hours away, 4 hour commute.
For a year before I was going to find out where the next location was.
Okay, then, and then you move again, and then you still have 2 more years in a GP clinic before you become a full GP.
Yeah.
It's a very, very long road.
Yeah, but you know what? It's the right road, because at the very, when you think about it, a GP is out there by themselves. They've no access to imaging. They've no access to diagnostics. They're rowing their own canoe, and they have to decide. They have 7 or 8 minutes per patient, and you come in and they're trying to decide, is this a migraine? Is this a stroke? Is this a brain tumour? With no imaging.
Yeah, so, and that's for the patient who can get into the GP clinics,
exactly.
So many of them are closed to new patients.
Yeah.
Waiting lists are enormous. You're in Carrickmacross, aren't you?
I'm living there at the moment, yes.
I know a lot about the problems there. Even there's a lovely shiny new building recently built, but there are only certain days you can book appointments and so on.
Yeah, they're overwhelmed. And
they would love to have you.
Well, they're stuck. They probably would, yeah. But yeah, and it's a shame, because there's a growing population all over the country. But you just mentioned Carrickmacross. I think, you know, there's a vibrant population. There are lots of people moving into the region. It's a great place to live. So, but the services aren't keeping up with population growth. And it kind of does make me mad. Like, for the last few months, I've been watching people protesting outside, you know, hotels and things like this about, you know, giving beds to people less unfortunate and crying about services. And you're thinking, where have you been the last few years? Like, the GPs haven't just disappeared overnight. It's been like this for the last 10, 15 years. And you're protesting at the wrong place. You should be at the Department of Health.
Totally misdirected anger.
Yeah, exactly. And
blaming,
I understand why people
for
are angry.
Bad public services is not.
Which like have been bad for years. Yeah. And you see poor GPs taking the brunt of it as well around the country. Like, I've seen it. I've been on GP placement, and the conversation usually begins when the patient finally comes in. I spent ages trying to get this appointment and I couldn't get through. And the poor GPs, they're going grey, hair is falling out, saying, yes, let's get to the point here, because I need to really try and help you here. And it wears on them as well. It's hard for their well-being as well.
You're so right, because those protests outside those places have managed to change policy dramatically in government when it comes to immigration.
Mm-hmm.
And if those protests had been outside GP clinics by people in local areas, it would have affected things. It still
you
can.
Would imagine. I just think last year, remember Dublin Airport when there was chaos, when the pandemic, when everything finally reopened up, and within a few weeks the airport, they'd managed to find extra staff and the queues had cut down and this kind of stuff. We don't seem to do for public services in this country. Housing and health are the two main ones, I think. I think everyone needs to speak up, as in I think the whole system as a whole needs to speak up, because there's been a culture for too long of healthcare professionals, I think, accepting it. And I think part of that is because we genuinely do want to help people. And I suppose I should say, out of all of this, I loved working in medicine. It's great fun. It's so much fun. I actually surprise myself by how much fun there is working in healthcare. It really is. But with that comes a side of potential guilt, and you're also trying to help people all the time. And if you're campaigning outside the hospital and you're not helping people inside the hospital, that's definitely a perception. So I think that's one thing. But I also think the government needs to cop on a bit and look at the things that can be fixed very, very simply. Like, for example, I have to sit on a bin when I'm typing. It'd be a very easy win to go into every hospital in Ireland, sure, there's a chair for every doctor. Like, and the next simple thing would be to fix IT so that we're not losing hours doing very basic IT admin work. That would be ideal. If they did that alone, the working conditions would improve so much, there would be more time for breaks, and we might actually entice the people who've left to come back. Because if you ask people who've left what bothered them the most, it was the constant grind, the nowhere to sit, nowhere to rest, nowhere to eat, the IT. Like, the IT would break your heart.
I've heard that, and people probably aren't aware that since that cyber attack, which is just before the pandemic in 2020, things haven't been fixed since then, 4 years later. I know of one hospital where consultants share x-rays on iPads, their personal iPads, because they can't email within the same hospital.
Yeah, and you can't access your email on your phone, for example, but somebody's screaming at you, send that email because we want to transfer this patient to Beaumont, for example, and you walk into a ward and there's three computers, there's 10 people crowded around the computers, one might not work, you're shuffling people out of the way, you're trying to find your password, you're trying to log in, you're trying to find paperwork. Like, there's nothing streamlined. That's very frustrating, and I think
that's surely something that can be easily fixed if you just...
It's an easy win, and I'm sure there might be people working in IT saying, oh, that simpleton has no idea how difficult it is, and maybe it's true, but it's because I've worked in so many places and this country is such a hub of IT, like, nobody else seems to have this issue. So when I saw just...
We're the tech capital of Europe, we keep saying.
Do you remember
everywhere
a few weeks
except
ago,
the hospital.
There was an announcement how everyone's going to have their own access to their own health data on their phone.
The app which the NHS has had for years upon years.
Yes.
So this app, you had a grim laugh when you saw
it. I did, because I was like thinking, who's going to upload this up there? How is it going to get up there? And also, why haven't we got it?
What are you working at now while you take a break from GP training?
I can locum in hospital, so that's the plan. I'm going to do a bit of time doing a little bit
of that.
You
can locum in a hospital.
Yeah, okay. Exactly. And also aesthetic medicine, which has actually become really popular. And I know there are some doctors who look down on that because they see it as beautifying people.
But aesthetic medicine.
Yeah, which
that's
is basically Botox
term.
For the uninitiated, basically. But what it does do is give people like me, and it's often women who are doing it who have small children, I know what time I start, I know what time I finish. You're dealing with patients who want to be there. Nobody's sick. You know,
yes.
It's the walking well who just might want a little bit of a lift. Sometimes it's actually because people have migraine or whatever, and this helps. That's a whole other story. But people
Botox
are happy.
Is for migraines.
You can use it for migraine, for sweats. You can use it for muscle spasms.
Excessive sweating, we should
say. You can use it for bladder control issues, gynecological issues. Oh, yeah, its uses of Botox are wide and varied. Muscular pain. I know we just see it as the aesthetic stuff. There's actually a whole pile of stuff. And there's also more and more data coming through that when people look in the mirror and they don't feel they look as tired and stuff, it makes them feel better about themselves, which makes them better able to face into the daily grind and improves people's well-being in a roundabout way.
Do you ever tell people Botox is not for you? You're too young.
Yes, absolutely. You'd have to be. And, you know, you are a doctor at the end of the day and you have to be for the good of the patient. And you do have people looking for stuff that just isn't suitable for their face. You know, there's a bit of a culture. People come in, they say, see this guy's nose or see this guy's lips. I want these. And, you know, you can't. It's not going to work. Angelina Jolie's lips aren't going to work on the average Irish girl or Irish man.
Some of them try, though.
They do. And it's not a good look. And I think we saw there was an RT Investigates programme a few months ago of the bad practices. And is anybody thinking about it? Just make sure you're going to see a doctor or a nurse or a dentist, a medical professional who knows what they're doing for sure, because there are some people out there who are neither of those things. And it is a medical procedure. The risk of infection, inflammation, all that kind of stuff, it's huge.
And
but it's enjoyable.
A doctor, somebody like you, still in the training, you're going to know what to do. They'll be able to come back to you.
Yeah, exactly. Like, we'll help them manage complications, and we know what to do if complications happen, and complications do happen.
Well, how much is a shot of Botox now?
That is a good question.
I want to stop my eyebrows going up.
If you're just working on your eyebrows, you'd be spending, I suppose, you wouldn't have much change out of €150. But that stuff is expensive. It's made in Westport. It's a teeny tiny little amount of it.
It's a Mayo.
I know, typical Mayo. Huh? They manage to get their steak everywhere. But so it comes all from the Allergan factory in Westport, and a teeny tiny amount. It's hugely expensive. So I know some people think the doctor took €300 off me, but a lot of that money is going to Westport. And then the other chunk is going to my insurer, you know.
Oh, yeah. Oh, for goodness sake, yeah. There are a lot of people with eyebrows eyebrows halfway up their heads. What's going on up there? It looks ridiculous.
It depends. Maybe they had a facelift. Maybe it's nothing to do with Botox.
Oh, right. I never factored that in. I just assumed that's Botox.
Could have been a plastic surgeon. It could be sometimes bad Botox placement. And that's why, again, it's really important to go to a professional. So sometimes it depends where you put the Botox. The muscle will react in different ways, basically. So, yeah, you have to...
A botched job by someone.
Yeah, you have to be able to read anatomy. That's where it comes back to your medical training again, that you know where the muscles are in the face, you know how they react, you know where the arteries are, you know where the blood supply is, and you know where the nerves are. You don't want to be meddling with those things.
That makes sense. Because these are really important questions.
These are what people actually want to know. Nobody cares about the suffering. They just want to know, how do I get my Botox and how do I know it's safe?
We trainee GPs and the state of the hospitals. Well, listen, thanks so much. It has been fascinating. I'm sorry that you are a loss to the health system for now. Hopefully something changes, or maybe you'll just have to wait and you'll have to start again and go through all that stress of sitting on bins and so on. But you see, you have the passion for it.
I do, and I do love it. And I'd hate for people to think, oh, she spent all that money and had a miserable time. I didn't. I actually really enjoyed my intern year, as an example. I had amazing consultants, and they're lovely people who to this day I will contact and message, and they've been so supportive of me. And I'd hate for people to think that medicine's a bad career. It isn't, but it is a bad career for you if you're trying to do other things as well, because it's all encompassing and they haven't changed the model. And it's a shame, because just north of the border in the NHS, most people get flexible training if they want it.
Right?
And that may be an option for me in future as well.
Just up the road.
Yeah. I'm exploring that, you know, because...
Because you're in Carrick.
I'm in Carrick. And I did want to be a GP. I still want to be a GP. I always thought I'd be the GP who might do Botox of a Friday. Yeah. You know, but look,
that's
we'll
okay.
See.
That's allowed. And you've explained why that is. Look, it's been really valuable chatting to you. Thanks a million for visiting us. Moira Thrasa Ní Cailleag. Hopefully Dr. Moira Thrasa in the near future. Thanks a million, and go well and be safe.
Email Oliver@rte.ie.